It's so good to have you here today. We are nearing the end of our sermon series that we've been in for a few weeks called One Another. It's just this week and next week. Next week, of course, is Mother's Day. It's going to be a great Mother's Day here. I hope all of you moms invite your families, and we're going to have a great, great Mother's Day. And then 2 weeks from today is a really important day in the life of the church. It's Pentecost Sunday, and I hope that you'll be a part of Pentecost Sunday. We're going to be baptizing people on Pentecost. The first Pentecost, there was 3,000 baptized. I don't think we're going to hit that number. But if you have never been baptized, I hope that you will use this coming Pentecost as the day for that. And just let the church office know if you or if your children or teenagers would like to be baptized. Let Pastor Jake or Mallory or Trey know that. We'll have a special class. Or if you'd like to be baptized, let us know. Pentecost Sunday is going to be a great day. And we're going to end up after the 10:30 service and after the 10:30 Sunday school hour, we're going to have a taste fest. We did that last year for the first time. And that's a lot of fun. And we'll have food from all over the world. And you can taste that on Pentecost. Okay. But we're still in One Another today. And we've been looking at that phrase, one another, that's used throughout the New Testament to describe the body of believers, the community and body of Christ. And we've seen it. It's used a number of different ways, and we've looked at some of those ways where the Bible calls us to love one another, be devoted to one another, honor one another, live in harmony with one another, serve one another, receive one another, build up one another, encourage one another, comfort one another, instruct one another, pray for one another, rejoice with one another, weep with one another, confess sin to one another, show kindness to one another, give to one another. Last week was forgive one another. We haven't done all those one another's, but those are them in the Bible. And then today's verse comes from James' letter, where James writes, "Don't grumble against one another, brothers and sisters, or you will be judged. The judge is standing at the door." So our one another phrase for today is do not grumble against one another. Each week in this series, I've asked someone from the congregation to help us to understand really what the theme for the day is. And this week, I've asked Jerry Brockhaus, and he's agreed to be here. And Jerry's got your own cheering section. Hey, that's all right. Jerry, tell me, do words matter? Do the words that people say have an effect on the person to whom they're spoken?
Absolutely.
Can you give me, Jerry, a positive example? Someone who in your life, maybe growing up or maybe recent, someone who spoke into your life good, holy, godly type of words?
Yes. Of course, there were several times that happened, but one that really stuck out was, and people think this is funny, that a friend needed a horse broken, and he was too big to break the horse, and so he said, "I could do it," and people around me were saying, I was really small and skinny, and they said, "You can't do that," and he kept saying, "Yes, you can," and I did.
All right. I don't know that I've ever broken a horse, but there we go. Well, that's a good positive experience. Somebody who said you can do it when others were saying not. But tell me, I guess, the flip side. Do you have a negative example of someone who spoke harmful words into your life?
I do. The big one that comes to me is in high school again. And I had a music teacher called Sister Innocent. And she told me that I could never sing, and I have never sang to this day.
The words that people say, they have a lasting effect. I guess, Jerry, if you had to sum it all up, what would be the lesson that we should learn from all that?
Oh, golly. Every chance you get to put a blessing in someone, even if it's just a small word, just to give them a blessing, I think that's the key to everything we're about.
Great. I agree. Jerry, thanks for helping and sharing with us this morning.
Oh, hey, what's up?
Hey, did you say something to me, dork?
Ah!
What a stupid haircut!
Ah!
Oh, you gonna cry like a little sissy?
Oh, that's gonna leave a mark.
I've never seen a bigger loser.
Oh! Oh! Hey, cool haircut. Oh, me?
You need a hand.
Thanks.
Words. They're more powerful than you think. Use them wisely.
You're both a couple of dorks.
Whatever.
We're talking about the words that we use this morning. Our words can either bring healing and help, or they can be destructive and inflict pain. Whoever said sticks and stones can break your bones, but names will never hurt you, that person was an idiot, I think. Because words can do far greater damage than a stick or maybe even a stone ever could. In many ways, this sermon today is kind of a two-parter. It's this week and next week as we wrap up this series. And today we're looking at the negative aspects of our words. James' passage, do not grumble against one another. Next week we're going to be looking at the positive, next week on Mother's Day, the positive impacts of our words, where in Hebrews the writer says, spur one another on to good deeds. So the point of all of this is our words matter. Jerry talked about a teacher who had a negative impact on his life. I remember when I was a first grader, I had a very old school teacher. She was the type of teacher that used a ruler over your knuckles if you didn't do things right. She was very gruff to those students. Kind of, I told someone this week, to the students that were maybe the low-hanging fruit, she would frequently use very harsh words to. I remember I had a friend who lived just across the street from us, and she maybe today, maybe they would diagnose her as having a reading disorder, but she was certainly not, she didn't have any mental handicaps or anything like that. But this teacher, I can remember, even as a first grader, would be so harsh to her. I remember going home and telling my mom how this teacher had verbally abused this friend of mine. And I never understood it. And that was the only class that this girl and I ever had, but she lived nearby, and so I was able to watch her life. And quite honestly, she never really recovered from that. And I don't mean to imply that this one teacher was the cause of all of this lady's now troubles. I don't mean to say that, but I wonder what would have happened had, instead of saying harsh words and unkind words and being very abusive verbally to this girl, if she would have done the opposite, how her life trajectory would have been different if she had used kind words and grace-filled words. The passage that James is for us for today was written by James, the brother of Jesus, the half-brother of Jesus, not James, the son of Zebedee, John's brother, but this was written by Jesus' half-brother. In Matthew 13, we're giving a list of Jesus' siblings, and James is at the top of the list. So most Bible scholars think that James was probably the next oldest brother in the line. And if you remember Jesus' siblings, you'll know that Jesus and his brothers didn't always see eye to eye. In fact, his brothers thought that Jesus was crazy. They didn't think that he was the Messiah. In John chapter 7, when talking about Jesus' family, they were quite sarcastic to Jesus. In fact, encouraging Jesus to go right into the heart of the opposition. You would say, even in many ways, that they were encouraging Jesus to take a death march. But something happened to James in his heart and life. Well, when something happened, it was the resurrected Lord happened in the life of James. And as Paul is writing to the Corinthians in chapter 15, he talks about the appearances that the resurrected Jesus had, and one of those appearances was with his brother James. Can you imagine how that encounter would have gone? The older brother that you used to play around with and give Hertz donuts to and noogies or whatever, you know, now is alive. You thought that he was dead, but now you see him alive. You didn't believe what he was saying. You didn't believe what he was about, but now you see him, the resurrected Lord, face to face. He's not just anybody. He's not just that kid that we used to play around on the playground with. Now he's the resurrected Lord. And James became so transformed by that encounter that he was never the same again. In fact, James became a leader in the early church. And in the year 62, James was martyred for his faith, his conviction that Jesus Christ was, in fact, not just the older brother, but Jesus Christ was, in fact, the Messiah and the Lord. And so he wrote this letter that we have called the Epistle of James. Most Bible scholars think that he wrote it toward the end of his life, near his martyrdom. So maybe in the late 50s, maybe 60, 61, someplace in there. As you might imagine, because he's going to be martyred the next year, as you might imagine, the persecution of the church is starting to heat up. Nero was emperor. If you know anything about your Roman history, you know that Nero was a little bit crazy. A few years after James wrote this letter, Nero would burn the city of Rome and blame the Christians for that, thereby spreading the persecution of Christians to an even greater level than maybe it's ever been. And James is writing to this church folk who were enduring this persecution, who heard Jesus or heard tell of Jesus saying that he was coming back. Again, this is 60, 61, so about 30 years after the death and resurrection of Jesus. And so some of those folks are questioning that, and some of them are wondering, just what's going on here? We're being persecuted, and our friends are being killed for their faith. And Jesus said he's coming back, but he's not back. What's going on here? And so James is writing this letter, and he reminds them of the truth. Be patient, he says to them, my brothers and sisters, until the Lord's coming. See how a farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop, patiently waiting for autumn and spring rains. You too, be patient and stand firm, because the Lord's coming is near. Don't grumble against one another, brothers and sisters, or you'll be judged. The judge is standing at the door. Brothers and sisters, as an example of patience in the face of suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. As you know, we count as blessed those who have persevered. You have heard of Job's perseverance and have seen what the Lord finally brought about. The Lord is full of compassion and ministry. He's saying, hang in there, fellas. I know it's not easy, and I know the persecution is heating up, and I know it's tough sometimes, and I know all the doubts and fears, but hang in there. Jesus is coming. And in the meantime, before he returns, don't be a grumbler. God takes really serious the words that you use. Don't be that guy. Don't be a grumbler. You'll be judged. The judge is standing at the door. Don't be that guy. Our words matter. James is writing to a predominantly Jewish Christian audience. You know, remember, Paul wrote to predominantly Gentile Christians, but James is writing to predominantly Jewish Christians. So he quotes Job, and no doubt all of those, even just using that word grumbler, would have brought to mind a very familiar story to him from Numbers chapter 13 and 14. Do you remember? That's the passage where the children of Israel were just getting ready to go into the promised land, and they're grumbling and complaining and murmuring. It was almost a mutiny more than simple murmuring. God had said, go and take the promised land. It's yours for the taking. It's a wonderful land. It's filled with milk and honey. Even if you don't like milk and honey, you're going to love this place. It's the promised land. I'm giving it to you. Go and take it. Yahoo, we're here. Go grab it. And so Moses, you'll recall the story, commissioned some spies, 12 spies, and those James Bond wannabes went into the promised land to scope it all out. And when they came back, they saw how beautiful it was, and they reported, yes, the land is very, very beautiful. It's great. The vegetation is huge. But 10 of those 12 spies said, but we can't do it because there's walled cities and there's strong warriors. We're like grasshoppers in comparison to those monsters. There's no way we can defeat them. We may remind you, Moses, we're not warriors. We're brick makers. That's what we've been doing in Egypt, is making bricks. We're not skilled in the art of war. If this was a brick making competition, then we could go over there and we'd win for sure. But it's not. They've got chariots. They've got swords. There's no way. And Caleb, one of the two spies that believed that God really did want them to go in and conquer the promised land, he didn't refute the facts. He didn't say, no, I didn't see any walled cities. No, I didn't see any huge warriors. I didn't see any of that stuff that these, I don't know what they're talking. No, he didn't refute any of those facts. What Caleb said was, we should go and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it. But what followed is a bunch of grumbling and complaining from the rest of the crowd. And they were complaining against Moses, and they were complaining against God. Really, it was mutiny. And a majority of people followed the majority of the spies. And they said, if only we had died in Egypt or in this wilderness, why is the Lord bringing us to this land only for us to fall on our swords? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it have been better for us to go back into Egypt? And they said to one another, we should choose a leader and go back to Egypt. Whining, complaining, mutiny. There are a few lessons that we can quickly learn from their disobedience and obedience, and their grumbling. I think maybe the biggest lesson is that grumbling ignores God's potential. Those 10 spies and all of their inspiring of grumbling, they just didn't get it. They didn't get that the one that they are called to serve, the one who said, go and take the promised land, was also the one that opened up the Red Sea so they could get across. He's the one who's been providing quail for them so they could eat meat every day. He's the one that opened up rocks so they could receive water. Are you kidding me? God has done all that, and yet now they're complaining about some walled cities and a few oversized soldiers. They were no match for God, but they didn't see it. So grumbling loses sight of what God is doing. Grumbling jumps to wrong conclusions. Our wives will be taken as plunder. We would have been better off in Egypt. Are they serious? They were slaves in Egypt. They weren't better off in Egypt. Their wives were being taken as plunder in Egypt. Grumbling leads to self-pity. I wish we had died in Egypt or died in the wilderness. What kind of attitude is that? I'd rather be dead. Grumbling thrives in an atmosphere of fear. In verse 9, I didn't read verse 9, but in verse 9, Caleb and Joshua tell the children, don't be afraid. We can do this. We can handle this. Don't be afraid. What are you fearful of? Don't worry. Grumblers tend to forget. They feel insecure and threatened. And the children of Israel had forgotten what God has done. I think that's the key. We forget how God has rescued us. We forget how God has worked. And we get stuck in just that fearful of what the future is going to hold. And then grumbling leads to rebellion and mutiny. And the end result is dissatisfaction and dissension and critical and just a bunch of grumpy, grumpy people. Grumbling and grumpy, they're all part of the same word. And who wants that? Who wants to be labeled a complainer? Those are not becoming qualities. I think the lesson from Numbers 13 and 14 is the majority report. Because that's what people were listening to. The majority report can be wrong. And a lot of people grumbling doesn't make it right. And it doesn't mean that the grumblers have got it figured out or found out some secret of truth that they're upset about. No, it might mean that misery loves company. That's what it may mean. And fear and insecurity, they usually don't have a problem finding a crowd. And so a crowd of grumblers doesn't make the decisions right or good or holy. It just might mean that a bunch of grumpy people are hanging out together. And in Numbers 14, the grumblers, talking mutiny, talking, you know, getting rid of Moses and Joshua and Caleb and heading back to Egypt, that's when God speaks. And it's not a good time, I suppose, ever to go against what you know God wants you to do. And so the rest of 14, God is saying in no uncertain terms that he's not happy with all the grumbling. And he said, you know, go and take the promised land. And they said, no, we'd rather not. And that's not good. And so in chapter 14, God lets his feelings be known about that. And as you might imagine, it doesn't end well for the grumblers. In a nutshell, they get their wish. So we wish we would have died in the wilderness. God says, okay, if that's what you want. All of you will die in the wilderness, and none of you will go into the promised land. And so for 40 years, they wandered around rather than possessing what God had given them. How sad is that? And the point of all this, the point of Numbers 13 and 14, the point of James' passage in his letter, God takes serious the words we use. And negative, grumbling, murmuring, complaining, it isn't just idle conversation. The words we use matters to God. Just like in Jerry's life, the words of that teacher has affected him for years. Just like in my friend's life, the words of that teacher affected her for years. Our words matter. Let me take off my preaching hat and put on my pastor's hat. Because I was worried about us, quite frankly, as pastor, as we navigated through all the transitions and changes that we've gone through in the last, you know, month or so. We, you know, if this is your first Sunday here, we've changed, we flip-flopped our services, and we added, Sunday school was in the middle, and we broke it up, started 11 new Sunday school classes, I think it is. And I was a little worried about all that because we change things for everybody. Not every single person in the church had a change. And I was worried about that. I was hoping that everyone would say, yahoo, let's do it, let's be gung-ho. But you never know for sure. Can I say that? And we worked, we prayed so much over this, and we worked hard, and the board was unanimously behind it, and we met with Sunday school teachers and youth council and